When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is my old pal J.A. Adonde. You know his work, of course, from ESPN, Around the Horn, previously as a columnist for the L.A. Times. And of course, he's now director of sports journalism at Northwestern, bringing up the next generation of great sports journalists. J.A. and I covered the Shaq and Kobe Lakers back in the day, and he's also an L.A. native who grew up on the Showtime era. So there's no one better to put in context the disaster, utter disaster and disappointment that is the current Lakers. So we dive into all that, the Westbrook trade, LeBron, what it all means, where it's all going, just kind of the historical context. We go into that in depth, as well as where we rank Greg Popovich now that Pop has become the all-time winningest coach in NBA history. And J.A. has some phenomenal stories from his time as a sideline reporter with ESPN, doing those harrowing, infamous in-game interviews with Pop. A lot of fun stuff there. And speaking of great coaches and great coaching, we also get a little bit into the Coach of the Year race at the end of our conversation. It is a large, large field for this season. Before we get to all that, a quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Catch the video version on YouTube. Just search for Sports Illustrated Podcast. You'll find us there. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my chat with J.A. Adonde is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by my good friend, J.A. Adonde. J.J., how are you today?
What's going on, Bizzle?
What's going on? I don't think we have to explain J.J. and Bizzle again to the audience. Go look it up on a previous podcast. I think we've explained it at least once. Good to see you. Been a while. I don't think I've seen you in person, actually, since I came to speak to your class at Northwestern.
The All-Star game.
All-Star weekend of 2020.
Yeah. Right before the world shut down.
The last time I was in Chicago, last time we've seen each other. So at least in person. Good to see you via Zoom. I wanted to bring you on because there's so much to talk about, and especially with the Lakers, a team that you and I know very well and have long histories with. And of course, you grew up in Lakerland as well. And so I want to get the historical perspective on what they're going through right now, because it is, I don't even know where to begin. We'll get to that in a minute. But I want to start with this, because Greg Popovich became the all-time winningest coach, at least in the regular season, just within the last week. I wrote about that and about kind of the totality of what Popovich's legacy is beyond just the wins. So I want to talk a little bit about where he stands in the pantheon, but I wanted to start with this. You have had the pleasure slash honor slash harrowing experience, whatever we want to describe it, of being the on-court reporter, the sideline reporter, doing the in-game interview with Pop. And so I just figured I'd throw this out there. Your best Pop story, good, bad, or otherwise, and it doesn't have to also be the sideline in-game interview. It could also be anything off to the side, because we know that Pop contains multitudes when it comes to the media and our experiences with him. He can be great, and he can also be a little bit challenging. So your best pop memories or experiences?
I mean, I'll tell the one, my very first thing I had to do on air as a sideline reporter was interview Popovich in game one or after the first quarter in my first game. And it was made even worse because the first game went long. So that meant we didn't have time to do my usually as a sideline reporter, you do after the first time out, you come back and do a little news update. And that could have gotten my feet wet, but we scratched it because the game before ours went long. And then so now, as it turned out, my first time on air as a sideline reporter is interviewing Greg Popovich. Well, welcome to the job, kid. And to make it worse, so every time I've been using the microphone, I've been pressing the talk back button to talk to the director and the producer in the truck. So I just got in the habit of pushing the button on the microphone, which cuts off the sound to the broadcast, and you're just speaking directly to the people in the truck. And so I was pressing the button every time. So we taped the in-game interviews, and I said, "Welcome back to Staples Center." You know, I start asking Popovich questions. He starts answering, and then they get in my ear and they're like, "You got your finger on the button. You're pressing the talkback button." So I said, "Hold on, Pop. We got to do this again." And he actually he started off joking with me because, I told him it's my first one. Go easy on me. So we start off. He puts his arm around me, like, "Hey, buddy, is this your first radio?" So he's all friendly and chummy. And then I tell him we got to start and stop and do it again. And now, you know, he hates doing this enough as it is. He was willing to put up with me because my first time, we had a pretty good relationship. But now we had to do it again. And now he wasn't pleased. And you can find that clip. It's on YouTube. It didn't go over very well. Also, I didn't have a question because, you know, they say don't ask a question you know the answer to. And watching that game, they were getting the offense was working well. The defense was going well. They were just missing shots, just plain and simple. Like, that was the analysis. They were missing shots. And I couldn't think of a way to phrase it. And so I just said something like, "Pop, you know, you shot 7 for 23 or whatever it was in the first quarter." I said, "You can't be very happy about that, can you?" And he said, "You're a very incisive young man."
Brutal. But he knew you before, obviously, like, you know, you and I both come from print background. He knew you, right? He knew you as an LA Times reporter or even ESPN print reporter before you did the on-air, right?
And because we'd spent so much, you know, there'd been Lakers Spurs seemingly every year in the playoffs, right? So we'd spent a lot of time together. And the thing was, you know, he gets along with reporters if you put thought into the questions.
Yes.
And if you ask him intelligent questions, he'll give you an intelligent answer. It's still intimidating. I remember during the NBA finals, like those Heat Spurs finals, I like to get up early and take a walk on the beach in Miami. And I'd be walking up and down the beach at like 6 a.m. trying to figure out what my questions were going to be to Popovich. You know, I'd be like plotting it in my head because you only get one shot. If you ask a good question, you're going to get a really good response. But you have to come correct with the questions. I'll do the opposite experience. My best Pop interaction, it's funny because actually I had to get up early and take a cross-country flight. I was working sidelines on a game in Miami. The Spurs were in LA and they had an off day in LA and they're scheduled to practice. And I really wanted to talk to Popovich just about the whole process that they made from coming back from that heart-wrenching loss. Game 6, the Ray Allen shot, the championship was in the Spurs' hands. I wrote about it, how the golden rope was around the court. You know, they were getting ready to seal off the court so they could present the trophy to the Spurs, and Ray Allen hits the shot, and they lose the next game. But then they come back the next year and dominate, right, and put together one of the most impressive performances we've ever seen in the finals. And I just wanted to talk to him about the process, how they converted that pain into that triumph. And, you know, I flew cross country. I landed. I hopped in the car, drove up to UCLA where they were practicing. I get there just in time, and he was kind of in a bad mood at first. I was like, "Oh boy, he's in one of those moods." You know, somebody else asked him a question. He was shooting down questions left and right. And then I just pop. I want to talk to you about this. I pull him aside, and we wound up talking for 10 minutes. And just the thing was about how you deal with loss. And how you process defeat, and when things don't go your way, how you're going to respond. And he really got interesting and deep and philosophical about you know, he talks about the accident of birth and you know, how privileged so many of us are. And we need to recognize how lucky we are. Even when things aren't going our way, we still have it better than, you know, 99% of the people on the planet. And just how you handle defeat. And he says something interesting is that he wasn't impressed about the way they came back the next season and won the championship. He was impressed by the way they came back and competed in game seven. That game seven, coming off, again, one of the most, you know, gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching losses that any team has ever suffered in the NBA Finals. And that next game seven, 48 hours later, was like back and forth. And he told them, I'm proud of the way you competed in that. And you got off the deck and gave the Heat everything they could handle. So it made me rethink, like we think about how the Spurs triumphed in winning the championship the next year. But to Popovich, the triumph was the way in which they competed, even though they lost that game seven.
That's a great one. That's a great one. And that's the thing, like, that I like that you've given listeners like the two sides of Pop there, because I think people get just the one impression often. They see the snarky, snippy answers, either in the in-game interview or even post-game at the podium. Pop hates the podium. He hates the scrums, as we call them, when we're just this gaggle of reporters around him. But my experiences over the years have always been, if I went to him, similar thing. I've got a feature I'm working on, a trend story I'm working on, a thought. And I would, after the scrum breaks up pregame, hey, Pop, I got this thing. I just curious your thoughts on this, whatever. And if he liked it, he was great. If he didn't like it, he'd sort of just look at you and go like, yeah, no, that's not a thing or whatever. Like he'd just be, you know, he'd say, I see what you're saying, but no. And he'd be kind about it. The times where he is snippiest or seems harshest is usually the on-camera stuff. I don't think he likes the cameras, period. I don't think he likes cameramen, camera people. That whole setting. But in conversation, or if it's just, you know, floating some ideas past him, whatever, he's always great with that stuff. And he's not, and I'll tell this story, which I've probably told before. I'll tell it again. When I went out to do, I think it was the feature I did on Becky Hammon when they first hired her, and it was the first time he'd shown up at training camp with the full-on scraggly beard and the longer hair, and he was getting that mad professor look. I walk up, and this is a one-on-one, and I walk up. I say, hey, Pop, you know, good to see you, whatever. I said, you know, with the beard, I said, you seem somehow even more intimidating. And he goes, it's all just shtick. And he, you know, waves his hand in the air. And that's it. Like, that's it. Like, it is and it isn't, right? Like, if you're on the receiving end of the worst part of what he's calling shtick, it doesn't feel like shtick. It feels like, damn, I just got sliced and diced on national TV. But I think he does view it that way. Like I don't like this, and so I'm going to act out a little bit, but it's not really me. And if you know him well, we know that that's not really him. Like, there's a lot more there.
And, you know, I knew not to take it personally. Like, he disagreed that the league made him do these interviews in-game. And I can understand. Yeah. You know, I always tell, you know, writers, if you're on deadline and you're writing a story back in the press room and somebody taps and makes you step away from your laptop and ask you a couple questions on camera, you'd be just as surly as Popovich. When our writers are.
I'd be worse.
You know, the flip side is, like, when you do sidelines, the pregame access that you have, so that, you know, the announcing crew will go in, you'll go into his office before the game, and he's great during those. Another Popovich story. So we got a Warriors Spurs game. You know, we used to stay in San Francisco when the team played in Oakland, and sometimes it could be dicey crossing the Bay Bridge. And I didn't leave with the rest of the group. I was doing something, and so I was going to drive myself over. Howard, it took me 45 minutes just to get across Market Street in San Francisco. And like, it took me like another hour to get across the bridge and to get to Oracle. And, so I'm literally sweating, and I'm like, man, I'm going to miss. And I did wind up missing the pregame meeting. So I didn't have a chance to butter up Pop and, you know, at least let him know I was there. He probably didn't even know I was going to be in the building. And so now, once again, the first time I'm going to see him is when I'm on camera holding the microphone at the end of the first quarter. And I'm sweating. And then it just dawned on me. I said, you know, you're not parachuting behind enemy lines to fight in war. You're going to interview a coach. It's not that bad. He can't do anything to really hurt you. And I just relaxed. And the interview wound up going really well that time. And then I had him a few days later in Portland, and that went pretty well. And now we started going, you know, we had like this good kind of camaraderie going. And I actually told him, like, you know, if you want to be mean to me, you can. I know you have an image to uphold. You know, I don't want to ruin, mess up what you have going. So feel free to be mean to me. And he's like, nah, that's all right.
I will say I have a much sentimental attachment to Oakland and great memories of games at Oracle and everything else as a reporter. But I do not miss making that, especially during the finals, going back and forth a bazillion times from Oakland to San Francisco. And yes, I know we could have all just stayed in Oakland instead, but I kind of like staying in San Francisco. It is easier now with Chase Center there. All right. So real quick, before we move on to the Lakers. So where do we put Pop all time now? I mean, the all time wins record in the regular season, obviously meaningful, but as every coach who ever gets on that in that tier at all will tell you, it just means I've been around a long time. They all say that modestly, and it's not false modesty. I think they all truly believe, like, they've been fortunate enough to stick around. And okay, that's true. But to stick around a long time, you also have to have some success for teams to keep hiring you, or in Pop's case, just be with one franchise for 1,000 years. And he long ago, as our buddy Mike Finger at the San Antonio Express News pointed out 3 years ago, he got the record then, if you count regular season and playoffs. Like, he was already the winningest coach in that regard. And why wouldn't we count playoffs? It's the most important time. But Phil Jackson still has the all-time record for playoff wins at 229. Pop is at 170. With his next playoff win, Pop would tie Pat Riley at 171. But Phil Jackson's got a pretty big lead on them. Phil Jackson obviously has a huge lead on everybody for championship rings and finals appearances. I'm not great at these things. Like, I'll rank them all time. I'm terrible at this stuff. But do you have a thought on how we should view Pop, whether it's in the modern era or all time?
See, I still put Phil ahead of him, in part because, to me, the big knock, really the only, well, I got two knocks on Popovich. One is that he never did win back-to-back championships. And I think winning back-to-back does speak a lot to the coaching and how do you keep your players hungry and motivated when they've just achieved the ultimate success. We saw the Heat have gone back to, you know, the great teams basically since the Lakers in 87 and 88 have won consecutive championships. The Houston Rockets even won back-to-back championships. You know, I don't think we count them among those dynasties, but they still got their back-to-backs. And Popovich never did that, despite having that core intact for so long. There are circumstances, there are injuries.
There always are.
You know, game seven moments that, you know, could have gone either way that went against the Spurs. So all those things happen. But the fact that, you know, he won five, but never got any back-to-back. When you look at Phil Jackson, every one that he won at least a back-to-back, you know, three three-peats plus that final back-to-back with Kobe and Pau Gasol. So again, we've seen how hard it is to defend the championship rather than pursue the championship. And that example I gave from the Spurs in 2013-14, just how they turned the loss. They were so much hungrier coming off that bitter defeat in 2013, and it just drove them. So what do you do when you don't have that drive, that hurt, that anger to motivate you? And he was never able to overcome that challenge. And the other knock is that I feel like he could only win with certain players, you know. Like, I don't know if it ever would have worked if he had anyone besides Tim Duncan and the temperament that Tim Duncan had. And Pop will be the first to tell you that Tim Duncan enabled him to become the coach he was, because Tim Duncan was willing to be coached, and the manner and the humbleness that Tim Duncan had just allowed the whole Popovich regime and dynasty to take over. Like, I'm not sure it could have worked with anyone else, right? Or very, very few people. Whereas we saw Phil Jackson won with the Michael Jordan group. He won with Shaq and Kobe. He won with Kobe as a lead guy. Those are three different superstars, although you could argue that Kobe kind of came from the Jordan template. But they're three different types of superstars that he won with. Pat Riley. And this is something Riley, like, to win with the Showtime Lakers, to coach and get to the finals with a completely different style in a different era with the Knicks, New York, which, yeah. I actually think, even though they didn't win a championship, I think that was his best coaching because he didn't have the overall talent. And then to win a championship with an aging Shaq that kind of squeezed the last that Shaq had in him. And, you know, that team, I mean, he won with Jason Williams and Antoine Walker. He won a championship with that group. you know, that's one reason I think I would put Riley ahead of him. But Popovich, the consistency, the buy-in, Mike Brown, you know, his former assistant, coach around the league, of course, now with the Warriors, says his people skills are just off the charts. I'll never forget him telling me that. Just and you look at his tree, right? Budenholzer just is the defending champion. That's off the Popovich tree. You know, how many people he's enabled and the Spurs have enabled both on the coaching sidelines and throughout the front offices in the league. So the Pop influence on the league.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure we can really write the final chapter on that yet, but that's one area he's vastly superior to Phil Jackson, right?
Yes.
Phil doesn't have a tree. Phil doesn't really have this sphere of influence.
I don't think Phil was interested in having a tree. Right? Like, it wasn't part of his thing. Like, Pop seems to want to develop guys. Phil had his same crew of trusted veteran assistants who were not necessarily, Clemens and Hamlin. Like, they weren't looking to necessarily go on. Now, Phil does have an influence, right? Like, Steve Kerr credits his biggest mentors as being both Phil and Popovich, right? Ty Lue absolutely credits Phil as being an influence, though Ty Lue comes off the Doc Rivers tree technically because that's where he got his coaching start, right? And it's totally fair. But there are guys who were influenced by him. Luke Walton, obviously fired earlier this season as Kings coach. But at one point, you could have pointed to Luke Walton, Tyronn Lue, and Steve Kerr as at least Phil Jackson proteges, if not directly off of a coaching tree that he planted.
Right. But it you know, they took what Phil gave them as a coach. But you know, they never coached under Phil.
Yeah.
Right. So it's different. I mean, obviously Phil Jackson, I mean, I put him at the top. So they learned what made him successful, but how many people did Phil Jackson put in position to succeed on their own as coaches or as executives? Whereas I think Popovich, you know, and very intentionally too, you know, I think Pop really wanted these people to succeed, and there was great intention with hiring Becky Hammon and trying to position her to be a head coach in the league at some point. So the intention that Pop had in mixed with the success, you know, any success off the Phil indirect tree, as we'll call it, the shrub. doesn't come with the same type of intention that Popovich has.
Agreed. Yeah, right. He influenced a lot of people, but he wasn't cultivating. He wasn't trying to say, like, this is how you do what I do. There was no mentoring as a head coach to other coaches, which I think was what Phil was trying to make up for when he moved back, like when he ended up running the Knicks badly. I think what he wanted to do with hiring Derek Fisher was, and initially trying to hire Steve Kerr, was he wanted to now be a mentor figure from the front office, which is not exactly the right role of a team president anyway. But I think that was in part what he was attempting to accomplish. So yes, Pop's influence and the tentacles, the branches of his tree are so, widespread. And you're right. The chapter hasn't even been written because, like, Ime Udoka just started his career and is doing great things in Boston now after a bumpy start. And, you know, we're going to be talking about Pop proteges years beyond when Pop hangs it up, whenever that is.
I just can't imagine him hanging it up.
I know, right? I can't imagine this league without him at this stage.
Yeah. It's funny. So they lost to the Clippers the year after they won the 2014 championship. They're losing the first round, the Clippers. And there was doubts about if Tim Duncan would come back, which he wound up doing. There was doubts about whether Popovich would come back. And for a long time, everyone thought that once Duncan hung it up, Popovich would be right out the door behind him. And I remember asking him, are you going to come back? And what do you think? And he's like, I don't know right now, but let me tell you that, you know, the money's pretty good. He's like, they pay us a lot of money. And he was said in a joking manner, but I really think he likes making that money. I'm not saying he's greedy or materialistic, but he likes making that money.
I think they all do. Fair. I also think my theory on this with not just Pop, with any of these guys, why does Larry Brown keep coming back, right? Like, it's, why did George Karl go coach the Kings? Why did Phil Jackson, when he was not physically able to coach, nevertheless decide to do something that he had really no basis for doing in running the Knicks? It's an addiction, Jay. I think like they can't walk away because this is so in their blood that they just don't know what to do with themselves without it. And like, yes, the money's great. And yes, Phil Jackson was paid handsomely to, you know, to run the Knicks, and Pop is being paid handsomely to keep coaching the Spurs, and George Karl was paid handsomely to go take on the Kings disaster and whatever. Like, I don't even I'm not dismissing that at all. Millions of dollars are not easily dismissed. I think these guys just can't get it out of their system. I think they don't know how to walk away.
Also, you'll never be the best at something again. And a lot of those guys you taught, I mean, Larry Brown, even with only, you know, one NBA championship, a lot of people thought of him as the best coach out there. I mean, a great coach, did great things. I always say the fact that he had a winning record with the Clippers, you know, at the time that he was there with the Clippers is, to me, the greatest testament to his abilities. You know, we saw with Tom Brady, like, that's why I don't begrudge athletes when, you know, they waffle on retirement or keep coming back after we want them to retire, is because they'll never be, you know, able to do this again in their lives. And with coaching, you can continue to do it even in your 70s. How do you walk away from something when you're the absolute best at it, when you're as successful as Greg Popovich has, and when you enjoy it? We talked about the grooming and the instruction and the you know, the influence that he likes to have. I get the sense he likes these young. He's kind of been invigorated by taking this new team after he had that great veteran core for all those years. He likes the challenge of, you know, turning these guys into competitive NBA players.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to the Lakers. As tortured a subject as this may be, I want to actually throw it open with this tweet, actually, from Anthony Irwin, who is a diehard Laker fan and podcaster. You can catch his Lakers Lowdown pod, which he's been kind enough to have me on occasionally. He tweeted this a couple days ago. Forget least popular team in Lakers history. I don't think a fan base in NBA history has hated a team the way Lakers fans do this one. That is where hardcore Laker fan Anthony F. Irwin and I think many other fans are on this team now. You grew up in LA. You grew up on the Showtime Lakers. You and I covered the Shaq and Kobe years and the Shaq and, or the Kobe and Powell years, everything else. So I want to maybe tee it up this way. Is this the worst good team they've ever had? Meaning you have LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and Russell Westbrook. So there were expectations. So yes, there have been worse teams that they've had, maybe worse seasons. But in terms of a team that had elite talent on it, is this the worst good team or the most maddening, the biggest disaster? Like what's our three word, caption for the season?
Three words. Yeah, I think the single word you use, disaster, feels more appropriate. It's funny because we tend to think of, you know, the year that Karl Malone and Gary Payton were there as disastrous. But that team still went to the finals won a game in the finals. And despite all that was going on, and, you know, we were aware of all the turmoil behind the scenes. And then when Phil Jackson released his diary of that season, it turned out it was even worse than we thought or knew. And yet that team still went to the finals. So we think of that as an example of, you know, stacking a super team and it not working out. This is what it looks like when you try to assemble a super team and it doesn't work out. And the thing is, all these things, or a lot of them, were easily foreseeable. Anthony Davis getting hurt. When does that ever happen? the fact that they counted on Trevor Ariza to play a role on this team. And then he got hurt before the season even started. And Trevor Ariza was on the 2009 Laker championship team, and I know LeBron's been in the league and been prominent for all that time, but we're like, God, you think, like, is Trevor the only player from that 2009 Laker team still even in the league? It felt like a long time ago. And you're like, all right, he's supposed to play a role on this team. We love Trevor, but like asking him to really contribute at this point in time is asking a lot. So there were a lot of worst case scenarios, but easily predictable scenarios that came into play. I don't think we envisioned Westbrook being this bad. I was telling somebody yesterday, this is where I wish somebody, I wish Westbrook had a guy, a confidant in the media. And I would love to hear him sit down with someone and or have someone that could elicit a really honest, forthright conversation about what went wrong. I mean, there might be some things that are beyond his control, you know, and maybe the Lakers should have thought about having Westbrook in a position when he, you know, LeBron's going to have the ball the majority of the time and you're asking Westbrook to play off the ball as much as he's been asked to do, just isn't conducive, right? What is it about Frank Vogel's offense or system that doesn't work for him, you know, specifically? Which might be very well be legitimate basketball issues that should have been foreseen and haven't been. You know, I would love to hear that debriefing from Westbrook, and I don't think we're ever going to get it.
That's a great point, Jay. I mean, even, you know, over the course of the, you know, years, decades that you and I have followed or covered this league as reporters, even guys who have been, not necessarily the most open with the media or might have had some difficulty or just tension with the media, usually at least, you're right, had a guy. There was somebody that they would be willing to open up with at, you know, maybe once a year or once every couple of years. And I, you know, the idea of Russell Westbrook bearing his soul seems like ludicrous on its face because of everything that we know of him in his time in the NBA. That's not a, he's not a bearing the soul kind of guy. Maybe to somebody, maybe his wife, his family. But aside from, you know, occasionally letting his guard down just enough to say, yeah, it hurts to have people say Westbrook, or, you know, a couple other times where I feel like he's been like, you know, showed like a percentage point of vulnerability, but he's not going to really open up to say like, we're never going to hear him say something to the effect of, this is the most difficult season I've ever been through, right? We can see it on paper. Statistically, this is the worst season of his career. And we can see in the abstract, this has been just a nightmare for everybody involved and for him in particular, and as a very prideful guy. But to hear him describe it as he's living it, as he's feeling it, and how he's processed it, and how he thinks he can somehow still turn this around or rebuild, or whether it's with the Lakers or probably somewhere else next season, what he's still got left. I don't think we're ever going to get that. It's a really interesting point. Like we'll see what happens next, but we will not hear him process it in any kind of way that lets us in or gives us any insight into who, you know, Russell Westbrook is.
You know, and think, you know, we've been thinking about Laker teams in the past. Like this reminds me in some way of the 2010/11 Lakers. So they're back to back defending champions, and they remember just all fell apart in the
crash and burn against the Mavericks. Yeah, against the
Mavericks, and they got swept by the Mavericks. And Kobe had an outstanding season. He was still very much Kobe Bryant at that point in time, but it felt like he never infused that into the team. And it felt like the team never followed him. And I'm seeing that with LeBron. I mean, we're seeing some phenomenal performances from LeBron, you know, especially at age 37, but, you know, to still be producing 50 point games and to still be producing some of these masterpieces, individual masterpieces, but it's not being infused into the team. There's a disconnect there. And that reminds me of Kobe's last year or that last year of contending for the Lakers, I should say, which was that 2011-12 season. And then remember, and well, I mean, we're talking about things that didn't work out. The Dwight Howard, Steve Nash assembly did not work out at all. That was, to me, two factors. I mean, clearly the just clash in attitudes and approaches to the game between Dwight and Kobe, that just didn't work. And then, you know, Steve Nash broke down.
Yes.
Similar to the way some of these Lakers are breaking down. But also Kobe basically turned Steve Nash into a spot up shooter. You know, like Kobe wasn't willing to relinquish the ball enough to let Steve Nash do what he wanted to do. Yeah. So like that, but I feel like that team, to get back to the Anthony Irwin tweet, that team, the Laker fans didn't turn on that team the way they turned on it. Like, they turned on Dwight Howard, but they didn't turn on the team. And I felt like they and one of the reasons was because they still had Kobe and they loved Kobe. And like the defining moment of that season, remember, Dwight gets kicked out of the last playoff game, gets two technicals, gets sent out. So he's going back to the locker room. Here comes Kobe, you know, fresh off the Achilles tear, comes hobbling out to the bench on crutches, you know, ships passing in the night. I think it's very intentional on Kobe's part. So he gets a rousing standing ovation. You know, the fans know this is going to be their last chance to see Kobe that year. So here's this cheer for Kobe. So think about it. As the team is getting swept out of the playoffs, their star acquisition, you know, gets kicked out of the game, doesn't even get to finish the series. And it still ended on a high note because the fans were happy that at least they got to see Kobe one more time and wave goodbye to him for the season. So it's just a different relationship that team had and with the fans. And this one, like this team, as soon as the Lakers lose their last game, I think the fans are going to be like, good riddance. Get out of here. I don't want to see you guys again. I don't want to see this collection of players again.
So there were worse LA, there are worse Lakers seasons. There are worse experiences, but like this still has to be, I don't know. Is this the worst Lakers season of all time when we consider all the factors, right? Not the worst roster they've ever had. May not be the worst record they've ever had or anything, but when we consider who they have, what the expectations are and everything else, does this then rank as the worst Lakers season of all time?
Yes, because again, there's not that thing to enjoy. And some of the bad teams, the underdog teams, I think the fans rallied behind them. Just it's fun to be the outsider, you know, the challenger. Like some of the loudest I remember being at Staples Center when it was still Staples Center was those years they played Phoenix, in particular when they got up 3-1 on Phoenix. Remember that Kobe game? He hits the shot to send it into overtime, hits the shot to win it in overtime. Yes. That's about as loud as I heard it. Why? Because the Lakers were the underdog. It's fun. Everyone wants to be the underdog, right? And Laker fans rarely get to be in those shoes. And I feel like they love that team, maybe even more than the three-peat teams, just because every success was a bonus, right? And the fact that we were on the verge of beating an excellent Suns team that year in the playoffs was a bonus. And they love that team. There's just no love for this team, you know, and the fact that they didn't get to celebrate with the parade when they did win the championship. You know, the fact that so few players from that championship team are still on the roster, you know, it's just, it feels like it's just LeBron and Anthony Davis. Right. And we haven't seen much of Anthony Davis this year.
It literally is, other than Dwight, who left and came back. And there was also Rondo, who left and came back and then was shipped out again.
You know, it's not like they don't have the Kurt Rambises of the 80s or the, you know, the Luke Waltons or, you know, the Mark Madsens, you know, like some of the
through line, favorites. The guy who was there for everything. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Derek Fisher, you know, like those guys, the steady, you know, sort of underappreciated guy who is there and the fans can relate to. So like, what does this team have? You know, and you know, Westbrook is from L.A., so there should be that bond there. But he was the villain for so long, too.
Yeah.
In L.A., like, you know, the he was a rival with the Thunder. And so LeBron, who, you know, was the rival to Kobe for so many years and it feels like the fans had never truly embraced him. It's just weird. But I feel like this is the template going forward. Right. The next great Laker team is probably going to be look like this in terms of it'll be an assembly of players who weren't, you know, drafted and kind of came up only wearing Laker jerseys. Right. Like just the way the league is now.
Yeah.
So I would say the fans need to use this as a training ground and realize that the next team that they're really going to fall in love with and root with and is going to deliver a championship will probably feel more like this team than it will any of the other previous championship teams that they've seen.
Mercenaries, basically. Yeah. And I get it. Like there, a lot of people are going to immediately be shouting, but you know, they were doing that in the past, right? Like Wilt Chamberlain didn't start with the Lakers. Kareem didn't start with the Lakers. Shaq didn't start with the Lakers, but you had Chamberlain,
Jerry West was there the whole time.
And you had Magic and Worthy.
And Magic with the Lakers. Right.
And then Kobe was a Laker draft pick acquisition. And yes, it's not all been strictly mercenary. There have been a lot of imports. Yes. But
And the Lakers are poised still. They're still poised to be the most successful in this mercenary or you know, among the most successful in this mercenary era, because they're still going to be a destination team with the resources and all the appeal. So, again, the next Laker championship era, the roster construction will probably look like this.
So as long as we're on worsts and how we're framing all this, if this is the worst Laker season maybe of all time, or at least in the modern era, is the Westbrook trade the worst transaction in Laker history? I think it is. And I haven't gone all the way through chapter and verse of every transaction ever. There's only like three other really bad Laker deals of the last, 15, 20 years that stand out, right? And you kind of touched on this. So they acquired Dwight Howard in 2012. They sent out Andrew Bynum, who at that time was a young, really talented center. Obviously, he broke down pretty quickly the couple of years after that. But they sent out Andrew Bynum, a first-round pick, a second-round pick, and some throw-in players that I don't even need to name. Dwight spends 1 year with the Lakers. They win 45 games, and they're swept in the first round by the Spurs, and then Dwight leaves. That same year, of course, they acquire Steve Nash. They sent out two firsts and two seconds. One of those firsts, by the way, has become Mikal Bridges. Nash played 65 games over two seasons, two playoff games. And then the other one, I mean, the Shaq trade, really. Like, they traded Shaq. Granted, Shaq wanted out. Shaq and Kobe wanted away from each other. There's all kinds of duress that they're doing this under. They got Lamar Odom, a very good player who never made an all-star team in his career, though. Key in a couple of championships, so you can say that that's the saving grace. But still, Shaq is still some version of Shaq. They trade him for Lamar Odom, Caron Butler, Brian Grant, a first-round pick, and a second-round pick. So those are the three that stand out to me, but nothing is at the level of this Westbrook trade when you consider the expectations that they had, the window that they have to win with LeBron, and the impact it's having not just this season but beyond, and the number of guys that they sent out who were valuable players that they're now missing and who are thriving or succeeding in various degrees elsewhere. I cannot imagine there is a Laker transaction in history that is worse than this Westbrook deal.
Well, I think we have to look at the cost. And so my thing with all the talented young players that the Lakers have shipped off recently in order to clear salary cap space for LeBron and in order to acquire Anthony Davis and now to acquire Westbrook, I don't think the cost has been that high, especially when you consider the fact that they did win one championship already. I don't know if they'll get another one, but my thing is, a lot of these players exceeded expectations and yet don't have any playoff success to show for it. You know, Julius Randle, not so much this year, but last year in New York, Julius Randle playing at an all-star level, getting the Knicks to the playoffs. I think they only won one game. They didn't win the series, maybe two games at most. Brandon Ingram playing at an all-star level in New Orleans. Lonzo Ball played really well in New Orleans and at the start of the season in Chicago. Kuzma's like leading the Wizards, like scoring, rebounding, and assists. But they're on the outside of the playoff picture. So like none of the players who have gone on to do and have done well, and you would argue they've all done better than if they had all been here, especially if they'd all been here with LeBron, like they wouldn't be as productive. They wouldn't put up the type of statistics that they have, but they haven't had playoff success, right? It hasn't translated into success for those franchises. It's been individual success for those players, but the franchises aren't substantially better off. So I'm not sure that the Lakers, you can say the Lakers would have been just better if they'd kept that team together and let those players grow and develop, because these players haven't shown that they can carry teams into the playoffs. So, and far into the playoffs. So for all these transactions that we look at in the Pelinka era, I view them through that lens of, the cost hasn't been that high in that we're not seeing these players that the Lakers have sent off take franchises deep into the playoffs.
But the Westbrook trade in particular, and you're right, like, listen, in the totality of this era, and also there's this, like, we can always boil it down to, if you win a championship, everything's justified. You can wave off everything. And I don't buy that in particular. Like I've said many times, I think, like, the Lakers, they won the Anthony Davis trade, but they lost the negotiation. They gave up too much considering they had all the leverage in the world, and that's costing them now because they don't have the assets to use. But they got a championship, so you can just kind of say, you know what, Howard, you're nitpicking. fine. They got a championship. The Westbrook trade is different, though, because this was, you're another year into this with LeBron. He's getting ever closer to whatever that finish line is, if there ever is one. And you have a small window, and you traded Kuzma, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Montrezl Harrell, all decent players of at minimum, all rotation guys, for a player that everybody in the league knew was not going to fit well with the team. And it's not just what you gave. It's not the net cost of what you gave up, even though those role players were important to them. It's that you missed out on the Buddy Hield deal. You spent so much on Westbrook that you decided you couldn't afford Alex Caruso. So there's all these other impacts of it. And then Westbrook himself doesn't fit. And now you have torched a year of LeBron's career at a time when he's still playing at an MVP level. So to me, when I say worst transaction in Laker history, it's the overall impact on every level. It's not just the guys who you sent out. It's the guy you got and how disastrous he's been. It's the lost opportunity to compete for a championship while LeBron still can lead a team somewhere. It's all of it. And like, I don't think there's a single transaction in Laker history that can match that level of catastrophe.
When you put it that way, Howard, with that totality, adding all those things in, yes, you make an excellent point. But Howard, could you tweet that? Could you fit all that in a tweet? That's the thing. In this era, you need to be able to be concise.
I bet I could. If and I had to, I could.
You can concisely say that, here's why. It takes a lot of explanation. And yes, when you bring all those other factors into it, you make a compelling argument there, Howard. But it's nice to be able to say, all right, they brought in Dwight Howard and Kobe had to tear up his Achilles just trying to get that team in the playoffs. And then they got swept in the first round and Dwight Howard left. that one was pretty, quick. Yes. And easy. But yeah, this one, again, I haven't been through it. It's sad. It would be nice to have it be a homecoming story. You see those Westbrook commercials where he's talking about, what he wants to do in the community and he really wants to have an impact. It can be tough coming home.
Yeah.
We've seen time. Is something particular about coming back to L.A. seems really difficult. I'm not sure how many good examples we have of people who came back to L.A. And then, Kareem came back to what was his second hometown. A New York guy, born and raised, but went to UCLA and felt comfortable out here. And he came back after being drafted by the Bucks, and that went well. I remember this isn't on the scale of the Westbrook, but like Andre Miller, when he came back to the Clippers. And he was from L.A., and I thought he was exactly what the Clippers needed when they made that trade. He led the league in assists prior to that. The Clippers needed a point guard like that, and that just didn't work well. And part of it was because he was back in L.A. He was feeling pressure from family members, trying to get tickets to games. It just didn't work. It just feels like there's a lot of examples of people that came back to L.A. and it didn't work. And Westbrook will go – how about worst hometown return transaction?
There's a couple I've seen here in New York, most recently now Kemba Walker, and that was a big, stirring emotional homecoming, and the fans love Kemba, and who doesn't love, everybody loves Kemba, but that's gone obviously terribly here. But Stephon Marbury, that was my introduction to New York. I got here to cover the Knicks in 2004 and he had just arrived. That one didn't go so well. It's the going home, you can't go home again, can go, however people want to spin that phrase. In the NBA, it often does not work out so well. Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, if you want to, they're obviously not from LA, but they're Southern California guys. And that was part of the exercise of going to the Clippers, was they wanted to both quote unquote go home. And that, we haven't seen the final chapter of that one yet. If those guys
can talk about Ty Lue for a second there. We mentioned him earlier. The fact that he's got that team in the playoffs, zero production from Kawhi Leonard, not a single minute from Kawhi Leonard this year. Haven't seen Paul George since December. And for this team to still be playing way above its head speaks volumes about Ty. How about worst transaction in Laker history? How about this one? Frank Vogel, the fact they couldn't close the deal with Ty Lue and Vogel. And again, they won a championship with Frank Vogel.
Yeah.
But they would not be in the position they are right now if Ty Lue was the coach. I think seeing what he's doing with the Clippers, seeing the success he had with LeBron in Cleveland, I'm assured that not only would they have a better, they'd be in a better place right now, but they'd be in a better place going forward. They would have certainty at the coaching position, whereas now, clearly Frank Vogel can't survive this, right? I mean, this is a gots to go situation now where you know, they're going to need to find another coach going forward. He's going to have to pay the price for this season. Someone's going to have to pay the price. It's going to be Frank Vogel.
It should be the front office, but the front office doesn't fire itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think Jeannie's going to do it.
Yeah. So if you had Ty Lue, you know, you'd be, I'm sure, a couple places higher. You'd be higher than where the Clippers are right now, which is ahead of the Lakers. and you would have some certainty in that position going forward. So I would argue that might be even bigger, a bigger setback than Westbrook.
All right. I'm going to say the Westbrook thing is a much bigger deal because the personnel, the players on the court matter most. But to your point, and it's a great point, I do think that Ty Lue has shown time and again his ability to, you know, adapt on the fly and get the most out of what he's got. And I do think has, you know, he's always been a great communicator, and you and I know this going back to his days as a player with the Lakers early in his career, where he just connects with guys. He's always had a way, and he's got a great head for the game, and we know that too, and he's shown it time and again. And obviously, LeBron wanted him, but how about this? Quick Coach of the Year aside here, I've got 11 potential candidates. Like, I know everybody's like, how can you possibly like it? Like, this is that's preposterous, Beck. You're like a third of the league, but there are 11 plausible guys to put on the three-man ballot. Ty Lue is one of them, but among the others are Jason Kidd, who the Lakers could have hired and who I think LeBron would have wanted, and Monty Williams, who should have won last year. He got my first place vote last year, lost in a narrow vote to Tibbs. Monty Williams, Ty Lue, Jason Kidd are all guys that the Lakers did have an opportunity to or were linked to, but did not get or did not hire. And then ended up with Frank Vogel. And I'm not knocking Vogel. He did infuse a defensive mindset immediately when he became head coach that was key in them winning a championship. It's not his fault that Rob Pelinka completely destroyed this roster with the Westbrook trade and the moves that were not made. But I think you make a great point, Jay, that like at a minimum, if it's any of these other guys, and especially Ty Lue, then they've got some stability and certainty there. You want to hear the other eight members of my
potential? You know, Taylor Jenkins.
All right. So the top tier, not top tier. I'm not tiering them right now. But there's four guys who come from teams that are that you would consider them as Coach of the Year because their teams are good to great. Right. That's Monty Williams, Steve Kerr, which I think a very difficult and challenging season. And he's incorporated the young guys. Kuminga and Moody have developed all that stuff. Spoelstra. And all like they've been without Jimmy Butler for long stretches, Kyle Lowry for long stretches, Adebayo for long stretches, and Ime Udoka, who we mentioned earlier with the Celtics. Then there's the group of, and Coach of the Year often comes down to the overachieved slash did something much better than we ever had a right to expect. So that's Taylor Jenkins with Memphis, Ty Lue with the Clips, Billy Donovan with the Bulls, JB Bickerstaff with the Cavs, Jason Kidd with the Mavs. We did not expect them to be this good. Mike Malone, perennially overlooked in these discussions, but again, we talk a lot about what Jokic has done without Murray and Porter Jr., what Mike Malone has done with a jumbled roster of role players deserves a lot of credit. And then and Chris Finch in Minnesota. So there's 11 candidates, and I don't think you can scoff at a single one of those. They're all worthy of at least discussion. I'm going to guess that given the diversity of opinions over 100 ballots, all of those guys will end up on multiple ballots in some place or another. And I'm not saying they're all candidates for the top slot. I'm just saying those are all guys who should be discussed.
It's funny. I've never had somebody jump into the forefront of my mind in this category this late in the season. But Monty Williams has done that because with Phoenix at the start of the year, they got off to that great start. They're right behind the Warriors, you know, and then they surpassed the Warriors. And I was thinking it was Chris Paul. And especially they didn't have Devin Booker for a while and they kept on winning. And I'm like, okay, this is about Chris Paul and what he's done for his franchise. But then since the All-Star break, they haven't had Chris Paul. They didn't have Devin Booker and they were still winning. And I thought this must be Monty Williams. He must have created some type of base and foundation that they're able to draw upon regardless of who's in the lineup. because they keep winning and they keep playing to their identity. They have buy-in, starting with Chris Paul, but clearly that whole team, everyone is comfortable with their roles and accepts their roles and thrives in their roles. You know, he had to deal with a disappointed DeAndre Ayton when the front office didn't take care of business and handle his contract. And he kept DeAndre Ayton from, you know, from wandering away and becoming discouraged and disgruntled and all that. Like, he's kept everybody in the fold and he's kept their heads above water when injuries didn't go their way. And they had what should have been a devastating setback with the loss of Chris Paul. So just a phenomenal job by Monty Williams.
Absolutely. I put him at the top of my ballot last year, as I said, and I might just do it again. In part because I think he should have won it then. And coaching is sometimes body. Well, maybe, but I think coaching is also sometimes body work anyway. It's like executive of the year is an even better example of this, right? Like, executive of the year, the work of a top team and a top executive is rarely one off season or one season full of transactions. It's multiple years. Coaching, it can be contained to that year specifically, but what Monty Williams has done over his couple of years with Phoenix consistently is outstanding.
I go back to New Orleans. If you want to talk about body of work, I still go back to that 2011 playoffs. The still the Hornets at that time played the Lakers in the first round. Lakers are defending champions. The Hornets took two games off them that they really had no business extending that series to six games. And it was Chris Paul and Monty Williams. It's that simple. How did they win two games when they were clearly outmatched and outclassed? Chris Paul and Monty Williams. And so you want to talk body of work. To me, it goes back to what he did in New Orleans. We've seen the challenges that franchise has in retaining its top tier players. You know, it's financially, it's hard for them to compete. You don't have any Fortune 500 companies in that market. And with those restraints, I think he overachieved there. And you could argue he's overachieving at least post All-Star break with the team in Phoenix.
Absolutely. It's this is going to be tough, man. I don't know. Those ballots are coming in a couple of weeks. So it's going to take some time to whittle this one down for my 11 candidates for coach of the year.
That's absurd, Howard.
And yet it isn't. JJ, this has been fun, man. Good to see your face. Good to talk to you again. Let's do it again soon.
All right, great catching up. And hopefully we can see each other in person before another 2 years elapse.
Yes, amen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Nutrafol, we don't just help your hair, we help your body grow it. Because it's never just about your hair. It can be your job, or your deodorant, or your lunch, or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets the key root causes of hair thinning. Discover your root causes and why we're the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.